just a rookie trooper, and he surely shook with pride. He checked off his equipment and made sure his pack was tied. He had to sit and listen to those awful engines roar.
You ain't gonna jump no more.
Hello, listeners. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to a very special Christmas broadcast of American Warrior Radio. Now, while there are some notable exceptions, the conflicts of men do not usually take pause for holidays. As a consequence, our military members often find themselves on the front lines or otherwise separated from their families during a time when most of us are celebrating with our families. Think about General George Washington's surprise attack across the Delaware River on December 25, 1776. The Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan on December 24th and 25th, and some believe those dates were chosen because the Soviets guessed that the response from the Western world would be delayed while they celebrated Christmas. Now, when I think about Christmas at war, my mind's eye is always drawn to the Ardennes Forest in winter of 1944. Life in a cold foxhole is miserable enough, but when the last major German offensive of the war interrupts your Christmas, well, that can really take the marshmallows out of your hot cocoa. So American Warrior Radio reached out to the veterans of the Battle of the Bulge Association to see if they had anyone who could speak to the subject, and they found us someone. Oh boy, did they find us someone. Our guest today was a young paratrooper whose 551st Parachute Infantry Regiment found itself making a tailgate jump into the Battle of the Bulge. But that wasn't the last time Douglas Diller would spend Christmas at war. He went on to serve in Korea and Vietnam. Ladies and gentlemen, American Warrior Radio is very pleased to welcome a member of the Military Intelligence Corps Hall of Fame, Colonel Douglas Dillard, United States Army retired. Colonel Dillard, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you.
I tell you, sir, honestly, looking at your resume, well, we've been over that. I won't get into it, but what an amazing career, sir.
Well, I've been very lucky.
Now, Doug, you enlisted at the age of 16,
yes.
The day before 4th of July, 1942, and you wanted to be a paratrooper.
Right, right.
Is that because all kids wanted to be paratroopers at the time, or what?
Well, my stepfather had already deployed to North Africa, and I learned how to play golf at Fort McPherson, Georgia, caddying for the officers there on Wednesdays and on weekend. And then these posters came out about... The one I remember most is this big poster showing a parachute and a trooper hanging in it. It said, "Pounce on the enemy like a falcon of prey." And I got really enamored with that, and I kept bothering my mother and said, I want to join, I want to become a paratrooper. And that was the newest thing for the Army that was going to eventually replace the fame of the cavalry. And then my mother reluctantly agreed, and we went in and signed the papers. And I knew the sergeant major there. He knew my whole family because of our living there around Fort McPherson. And he said, "You're not old enough." And my mother said, "Well, I've signed the paper, sergeant major." And he said, "Okay, that's good enough." So that started my 35-year career with the military.
Now, sir, like you said, paratroopers, that was a relatively, I don't want to say it was a new technology, but it was something new the Army was trying. And, I mean, you really, to become a paratrooper, nowadays you still have to be pretty tough, but back then, boy, you really, the bar was pretty high, right?
It was, and it was a new concept for the Army because the original battalion of parachutists was organized in 1940. In the latter part of 40, and then our unit was activated in 42 in December in Panama. So we were relatively new and a new concept that the Army was employing, and it was really untested until the 509 Parachute Battalion made the first jump in North Africa. And I've never regretted, never looked back on anything that I served almost all of my time. And the paratroopers, or later they coined the phrase airborne, and that's what we use today. And most of my career was with the airborne, 82nd Airborne, or Special Forces in Korea, and the latter part of the career in military intelligence. But I commanded a battalion at Fort Bragg that had an airborne element in it that could be committed with 18th Airborne Corps. So airborne was always, my motto was airborne forever.
Well, let me tell you, I'm trying to put myself in the boots, if you will, of a tough-as-nails 17-year-old from Georgia. I'm guessing I graduate as a paratrooper. First thing I do is run downtown and get a big old tattoo, huh?
Well, that was a stupid mistake that I made, and I had finished basic training at Camp Walters, Texas, and a group of the people in my training company said, let's go downtown and get a tattoo. And, you know, what the heck do I know? By then I had become enamored with some of these guys that had these great-looking tattoos, so I went with them and had that stupid parachute and tattooed on my left forearm, and I've regretted that all my life.
And there's a story for that.
Yeah, well, we were then transferred. We had to go through a physical training exercise at Camp Walters, Texas, before being accepted to go into paratrooper training, and it was a very rugged, really totally physical effort in that July sun out there in Texas. But anyway, when we were finished a parachute school training at Fort Benning, we were sent to what they call the frying pan, which is a replacement area for paratroopers waiting to be reassigned. And one night the medical officer came in and said, okay, everybody take off all your clothes, put on your raincoat, and stand by for inspection. And we thought maybe he was going to do one, you know, the annual short arm inspection to be sure that you were physically okay. So he came in, we took our raincoats off and turned around. And he looked at me and said, okay, you on the truck, you on the truck, you on the truck. And we found out that we had these stupid tattoos on our arm and we're going to be deployed overseas. So we had to go downtown in Columbus, Georgia, to the tattoo parlor. And the guy covered each tattoo with some kind of design. I ended up with a big rose over the parachute on my arm. And we were all a pretty bloody, scabby bunch for a couple of weeks thereafter that. For me to have the laser to take it off my arm, it'd probably end up taking an inch of skin off my arm, so I've never done that. Yeah, two layers of ink in my arm. And as I said, when I commanded units later, I'd tell my troops, show them my tattoo and say, don't you ever do this. You're going to be sorry. That's all I could do about that. But I just wanted to warn them, and I see so many people, including ladies with these tattoos, I don't understand it.
Well, and that's the voice of experience speaking. Folks, again, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined with the true, listen, all the folks we have on the show, American heroes. But this guy, Colonel Douglas Dillard, three wars, including Christmas at the Battle of Bulge. We'll be right back in a second, folks. Again, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to this special American Warrior Radio Christmas broadcast. We're joined by Colonel Douglas Dillard. Colonel Dillard fought in three wars, spent a lot of Christmas overseas, but we're focusing mainly on the Battle of the Bulge. Now, Colonel Dillard, as you described, he's a full-of-vinegar 17-year-old. Colonel, you made your first combat jump into France, I guess like 1 month shy of your 18th birthday, as part of something called Operation Dragoon.
Yeah, it was the 1st Airborne Task Force. It was formed up in Italy from the units that were in Italy at the time. It was a division-sized force commanded by General Frederick, who was the developer and leader of the 1st Special Service Force, and had gotten promoted to Brigadier General and given the task of forming that Airborne Task Force. And on the 15th of August is when we made our parachute assault in southern France, the second D-Day, if you will.
Now, you guys, as I mentioned, 82nd Airborne, that's a pretty good group. But you guys, within 24 hours, you'd captured a two-star general, as I understand it. But there were some difficulties with his surrender. Do you have any insight into that, sir?
Well, there were actually two generals. The first one, the resistance told us where his command post was in the city of Draguignan, which we landed near Draguignan, just a kilometer or so outside of the city limits, and and a patrol from B and C Company went up, surrounded the villa, and used a bazooka to blow down the door. And my good friend Sergeant Albritton led the squad from B Company, and they went in, and the general and his staff were all sitting around the table, and Emory, Sergeant Albritton, realized that the older looking guy must be the senior. He couldn't recognize his rank, but he went up and pushed his Tommy gun against the guy and said, "You're my prisoner." And he took the general's pistol, his PKP. And then they found out one of the staff officers I could speak English. He said the general then communicated with him and said, I have to surrender to an officer. I can't surrender to an enlisted man." So Emory got on the phone, the walkie-talkie, and a call company, B Company commander, Captain Evans, and explained the situation. So Evans came right over immediately and came in the room and identified himself. And Gerald then in his German said, "I surrender to you, but it's customary that we give you our pistol, but one of your ruffians here has taken my pistol." So Captain Evans looked around the room and said, "Okay, who has the general's pistol?" And, of course, everybody acted stupid like they didn't know what he was talking about. But Emory later, before he died, gave me the general's pistol, and I still have it. And one of these days I'll give it to a museum. But at the same time, we learned that the corps commander, this was a two-star general that we captured, that the three-star general was just outside of the city in a bunker. So at daybreak, my company formed up, and we went out and surrounded the bunker in spite of the sniper fire we're getting, and fired another bazooka round into the entrance to that bunker. And the general's adjutant came out and explained that the general would surrender, but he could only surrender to another general. So here we're another situation here. So company commander said, "Okay, we'll secure this bunker, and we'll get somebody from the 36th Division that was relieving us at the airhead to come up." So that was late in the afternoon by the time we were doing this. So the next morning, the assistant division commander, Brigadier General from the 36th Division, came up, and General Neuling, is Lieutenant General Neuling, the German Corps commander, surrendered to our American general. And that really wiped out their command and control system. So it was not a problem, you know, for 7th Army as they began to move up the Rhone Valley. So we felt very proud of the fact that we captured two German generals within 24 hours of landing.
That's great stuff. Now, your group then moved on up. You liberated the towns of Cannes and Nice.
Yes.
And then you were sent to northern France to kind of rest and re-equip. But about that point in time in 1944, Adolf Hitler had other plans for you, didn't he?
Yeah, he spoiled my trip to Paris. I was getting all ready to go the next morning, and we got a call to the sergeants. I was a sergeant at that time, to go to the orderly room to meet with the company commander. So we went down there, and he said, "The Germans have broken through. No one really knows where the front line is. So we'll get the men up early, and after breakfast, we'll draw a basic load of ammunition, get all our gear together, and get ready to leave." And we did then. The next morning, the trucks came, and we moved in open bed trucks full with jerry cans of gasoline up to we were supposed to go to Bastogne, but by the time we got to the Hotten, the village of Hotten, the SS had already surrounded the city and cut off our access to Bastogne. So we got orders to reroute ourselves up to Verbomont, and we joined the 82nd Airborne Division.
Now,
at that point, and bivouacked there for the night.
Now, sir, all I know is what I've seen in the movies, and those aren't exactly accurate. We're talking about December 16th or so. Were you all equipped with the right cold weather gear that you had, or
no? We had just come up from southern France, and we were still wearing a combination of the wool uniform, the regular Class B, that meant without a tie, or the jumpsuit, which is a cotton suit, and leather boots. And some people, I don't know how they did it, they managed to find an overcoat here or there, but we were totally, just like the 101st, some of them even didn't have ammo when they went into Bastogne. We're totally unprepared for that weather, and we paid for it dearly later with frostbite, trench foot, and you know a lot of injuries just from the weather.
Now, sir, I again a scene. I think it was in Band of Brothers, but I've heard you reference this as well. So you and your group are moving north towards the front lines where you think the Germans are, and there's just these waves of tanks and infantry and other troops going south, headed the other direction. What kind of morale impact did that have on you and your comrades?
Well, it really didn't affect our morale from a bad standpoint, but I remember since we were riding in open bed trucks, we could see everything, and I kept seeing troops moving south and tanks and other vehicles. I thought, what's wrong with this picture? We're going north and they're going south. And it was elements, a mixture of, I guess, the 106th Division and maybe the 75th that were totally they were new troops, and it was really unfair, you know, to disparage them much because they were just thrown in the breach there in a front that no one, the high command, did anticipate any real action. And the 82nd and the 101 was already surrounded in Bastogne, and we were moving up north to make contact. And I was just wondering, where are all these people going? They're going one way and we're going the other, and of course we soon found out because of the we reported into to 82nd headquarters in Bra, and were redirected to the 30th Infantry Division because they had already committed all of their troops and they did not have any reserve at all. So the General Gavin, General Ridgway, then ordered our battalion to go up to join the 30th ID on the north side of L'Eglise and constitute the reserve for the 30th Division, and we were there for, I guess, 2 days until we hit Christmas Eve. And I guess you're going to ask me about that.
Yeah, sir, we're coming up on another break here, so I do want to talk about that. Yeah. Christmas Eve and what it was like. You know, some of the guys are in foxholes. Real quick, sir, I got a minute. You had a career in intelligence. In retrospect, looking back at this, do you think the Germans achieved complete surprise or just caught us flat-footed?
I think it's a combination because on one hand, there were reports of amassing of troops and inactivity on their radios. And then with these new units that were up there, like the 106th Division, they were totally surprised.
Hmm.
It was I would think it was a combination. We did have some information, the high command, probably through their ultra system, and then the new troops there, and they didn't even have a chance to put patrols out yet where they might have discovered some of the advanced elements of the German army, but it just didn't happen. They were on top of them before they knew it.
Okay. Folks, your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia, a very special Christmas show. We're joined by Colonel Douglas Dillard. Colonel Dillard, not a colonel at the time, a sergeant at the time, spent his first Christmas at war in the Battle of Bode. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a very special Christmas broadcast of American Warrior Radio. We reached out to find somebody who had spent Christmas at war. We were first thinking about World War II and the Battle of the Bulge. What we got is a guest who had 35 years in the military, spent Christmas, or at least three Christmases, overseas at war, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. We're focusing on World War II. Colonel Douglas Dillard, coming back, just where we left off, your group had moved in and finally found a place to settle down. It's Christmas Eve. The Germans are coming across on, what, about an 80-mile front through the Ardennes Forest, and you guys are in foxholes with rifles, and they've got panzers. What? Now, as I understand it, sir, there was a plan for your paratrooper division to do one thing, but you got on Christmas Eve, you ended up doing something completely different.
Yes, we were in the early evening hours. We were alerted that we were going to make an attack on Christmas Eve. And the story behind it very quickly is that Colonel Joachim Piper, the SS commander of the Kampf Group or the battle group that was armor force that was leading the main element of the 6th Panzer Army Group in the north, and they were the forces that were to break through and make it to Antwerp. And the 30th Infantry Division had stopped them on the north, and then my other regiment of the 82nd, the 504 Parachute Infantry, had stopped them on the south, and Joachim Piper's outfit ended up in the little village of L'Eglise. And they set up their defenses there, and there had been several attempts to get into L'Eglise and capture the village, and they were unsuccessful. So our battalion then was alerted to make the night attack, and we're going to go north of through the woods north of L'Eglise and attack down through the woods from the north, which had not been attempted before. And it was snowing that night. We've been out in the field now since the 16th, and weather, not in any cover whatsoever. So it was pretty miserable. So getting orders to do something was better than just waiting around in a defensive position. And I guess we had walked maybe 30 minutes. We had to walk parallel to the German lines and then make a right turn to go into a tight position. And then the word came down, passed from the rear up front, that the mission had been canceled, turn around and come back. So we retraced our steps back to the bivouac area, and early the next morning we were moved back to the 82nd, but we learned later that the reason the attack had been canceled is that General Montgomery had assumed command of that area, and he had ordered that the front line be straightened. And if you can look at like you stick your one finger out across a straight line, the 82nd's position, we were holding positions surrounded by Germans on the three sides. So the 82nd reluctantly had to give up those positions, and the attack on L'Eglise was part of that order to cancel and straighten the line all the way across the front. And I don't know, maybe it was our luck that we would not have encountered such a heavy fight with Joachim Piper and his armored people that night. But that was Christmas for us. And the next day, when we got back to the bivouac area, we were passed out with some frozen turkey parts, and it was not very very delectable, to say the least.
So, sir, when we see those stories, you know, on the internet or in movies now, I'm guessing for a lot of you, as I opened the show, the war did not pause for Christmas. So, you know, maybe the chaplain says a prayer and maybe you get some turkey parts, but at least in your experience at the Battle of Bulger, there was not a lot of pause, was there?
No, there was any, and our relief was just to move back in the defensive position behind the 508 Parachute Regiment, and we were there for a night, and then we were given a special a recon mission to go through the German lines and capture prisoners. But we didn't know it, but the big counterattack was coming on the 3rd of January, and they wanted prisoners to get more information about the German defense. And on the night of the 26th, I believe it was, 24 hours later, our whole battalion was ordered to infiltrate through the German lines and capture prisoners and destroy anything that we could. So we did the infiltration at Norfontaine, and we lost one man that night, had a couple wounded in small arms fire, but I'm going to be going to Belgium the 4th of January. We're going to have a march of remembrance at that place where we did that recon that night, and I had such great respect for Joan and Gavin because we had to go out after dark, do our mission, and come back through the lines before daylight. And as we came back through the lines of the 82nd, Joan Gavin was down there at the outpost, and he said, you know, to us that it was really the first kind of contact that he had with us. He said, you guys did a great job, and it's really going to help us because the information that we had gathered on that night raid.
Now,
and just as a matter of interest, I was back there 15 years later and visiting the lady that they owned the farm. That was North Fontaine's, the name of it, and she came out, and my Belgian friend said, this is Mr. Dillard that was here and so forth, and she looked at me and said, why did you burn my barn?
Well, why did you burn her barn?
Well, it was that they were firing white phosphor shells in the German positions, and one of them hit the top of the barn and set it afire, and it was being used by the Germans as a aid station. And I said, we didn't intentionally destroy your barn. It's just war. And we became good friends. There were five daughters and a little boy hiding in the wine cellar there that night. And we became good friends for years after that. And I think all the daughters are dead now, but the son is still a young man. I mean, he's not young. He was much younger than them, so he's probably still around.
Well, sir, what a great story. Now, just so our listeners don't get the wrong impression, a little bit of facts here. We're about to go to another break, but the 551st entered the Battle of Bulge with about 800 officers and men, and by January 8th, there were only 14 officers and 96 enlisted left. Sir, I'm looking at your resume. I'm seeing a Distinguished Flying Cross, 2 Legion of Merit, Meritorious Service Medal, 2 Bronze Stars. I mean, this thing takes up a whole page, sir. The one thing I noticed, there's no Purple Heart. You went through 35 years without getting a scratch?
I was lucky, and I did. Well, here's the thing about our unit. The people never went to the medic. And I was, and when we were in the Southern France campaign there north of Nice, my hand was burned with shrapnel from a mortar that landed in the road right in front of me, but I wouldn't even think of going to the aid station for that. And now I see a notable person got a scratch during the Vietnam War, and he got a Purple Heart for it.
Yes.
No respect for him.
That's another story. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined by Colonel Douglas Dillard. We're talking about his Christmas at the Battle of the Bulge in World War II. We'll be back. Colonel, when we come back, I'd like you to talk about one of the last bayonet charges of the war. You were there. Stick around, folks.
Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, folks. A very special Christmas American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined on the phone by Colonel Douglas Dillard. Colonel Dillard served 35 years in our United States Army. He's retired now. And just some amazing story. I encourage you to look him up and just look up Colonel Douglas Dillard. He's also the author of 2 books, Operation Aviary, Airborne Special Operations in Korea, and Tiger Hunters, Special Operations in Support of the U.S. Army's Critical Struggle of Survival during the Korean War. Colonel Dillard, coming back, one thing in preparing for the show that I found interesting, a bayonet charge. You guys your commander or someone saw some machine guns that were threatening the troops, and basically he said, fix bayonets, and off you went. I think you called it a mad moment.
Yeah, we had spent the night in a fire break, and early the next morning we had to move to attack the positions moving down towards the Somme River, and part of the platoon, where the company had been already suffered a lot of casualties from mortar, artillery, and small arms fire, so we only had the equivalent of about 2 platoons, and one officer was there, left in Lieutenant Durkee. And he asked me to act as assistant platoon leader, if you will, because to help control the men. So the other part of the platoon was forward of us and moving off to our right front. And Dickie, a pretty sharp guy, and out of the corner of his eye, he saw movement in the woods off to our right front and realized there was a German force in there, and they were going to, they would fire on the right flank of our force that would be moving in front of them. So Dickie right away said, fix bayonets, and there's a minute or so to get that done because of the cold weather and everything. And he says, charge. And I was carrying a M3 grease gun, or one of these cheap Charlie machine pistols, and it wouldn't fire. It was all frozen up. So I had to use my .45 and fire into that mass of humanity. And as we charged them, the Germans had to turn in their foxholes around to their left to fire at us. So we caught them at a disadvantage, and it was a real mad moment, as I describe it. I'm sure it was a more than a moment. And I can still, in my mind, I can see those bodies with the steam coming up out of their mouths as they lay there dead. And we did a count later, and there was about 84 Germans that were killed during that mad moment. And then we had to immediately regroup because the Germans, when they lost ground, they always counterattacked. So my job then was to get our machine gun teams ready and in position to get ready for the counterattack. And it did come about 30 minutes later, and we were ready for them. So we beat it off and then reorganized and resumed our attack up into a commanding position overlooking the Somme River.
Now, was that Russian? How do you pronounce it? Rushenval?
Rushenval. Rushlinvale.
And that was pretty much the end of the 551st, huh?
Well, no. The next day, we're able to regain the high ground, as I said, and the train was all open. A lot of the troops were in tree lines, but we weren't. Our battle zone was completely open, exposed, and the German artillery observers across the Somme River at the village of Wany, which was on the hill, they could see everything we were doing, and we paid for it as we made the attack the next morning. And we lost a lot of people by artillery, and then my company, A Company, we were on the left flank, and as we got down, we had to go down an incline. We were going down, and then there was a creek down at the bottom of the hill, and then there was another hill at the actual edge of the village, and the Germans had about three or four machine guns in position up there. So when we got up there and started climbing up the hill, they unloaded on us. So they killed the rest of A Company, what we had left, I think the count we had one off. Lieutenant Dickie had preceded this platoon and knocked out one of the guns with a bazooka, but then they all opened up, and he was fortunate because he was on the flank of their gun positions. He's able to make his way back down, and he called to his runner and said, Pat Casanova, bring up the men. And he said, they're all dead, sir.
Wow. Wow.
So A Company then, you know, my company commander was killed with a machine gun burst right there at the same time, and we didn't know it, but our battalion commander was killed by artillery at the same time, back maybe 300 or 400 yards behind our position.
Wow. Sir, looking back at this, it's hard for me to even fathom what got you through.
Well, you know, we're young, and we think that we can do anything. And you always think, this is nothing new with me, but you always think it's the other guy that's going to get hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the good Lord was with me. And that's the only reason I was not wounded. That's the only explanation I can give for it.
Sir, you went on, and like I said, I'd love to have you back, because after the Second World War, you went on there's a title here, Director of Human Intelligence and Collection Requirements for the Defense Intelligence Agency. I don't even want to know what that is, sir. But you were doing special air missions behind enemy lines in Korea. You worked on the Phoenix program in Vietnam. And if I've got this correct, you were also original member of the Army Counterterrorism Unit, 1st Special Forces Operation Detachment Delta, which, if folks just remember that last word.
Yeah, and I have to correct that, because that's not really true. I think the confusion is that I was in Korea. I was with the 8240th Army Unit, and that was the Army's the clandestine operation element in the Korean War. And it was at that time. There's nothing really new in the Army. I have to first admit that. But our unit is considered kind of the forerunner of the special forces.
Okay.
Well, I think that's where the confusion comes in, because I never had any dealings with the Delta forces that later came on.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, let's make a deal. We'll have you back on the show. We'll talk about Korea and Vietnam. How's that?
Okay, I'll be fine. Be happy to do that.
Sir, we've got about a minute left. One of the things that, two things really quick. Your response to the term the greatest generation.
Well, I've always felt that to me, personally, it's kind of a form of discrimination against the other soldiers that fought. Well, in my case, I was in Korea and in Vietnam, and the guys had been all over the Middle East. And I'm not sure that we're entitled, because we happen to be living in that period of time, to be called the greatest generation. And I'm sure that my friend, I was just at Pearl Harbor with the Greatest Generation sponsorship, and I was with 14 guys that were Pearl Harbor survivors, and we all sort of generally agreed that we were just survivors. We did our job. We came out of the Depression, and it was a tough period, but we didn't think that we were the greatest, and it's just my own personal feeling.
Wonderful. Well, those are some very strong words to wrap this up interview, sir. I wish we had more time. Colonel Douglas Diller, thank you for your service to our country. Thanks for agreeing to spend some time here with us on Christmas. I'd love to have you back. You've got some great stories to tell about your career. We got about 20 seconds. Any last thought to the men and women out there currently wearing the uniform, sir?
Well, I think if they make the military career, they'll do well, and they should be determined to do what they're supposed to do to the very utmost, and just stay focused on your job and do it well, and you will prosper.
Wonderful. That's words that could apply to everybody's life. Again, Colonel Diller, thank you so much for appearing on American Warrior. Merry Christmas to you and your family and your grandkids, and we'll have you back on again soon.
Okay, airborne all the way.
Airborne all the way. Thank you, sir.
Right.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen, another great American Warrior Radio show. Check us out, AmericanWarriorRadio.com, on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Player FM. We'll see you next time. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.